Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Welcome aboard, everybody, and thank you for joining us for our late winter free-for-all. That's right, it is... I don't know, I guess in the summer we call it a melee, depending upon what quarter it is, but it's a free-for-all. Right now, we have Paul over in the chat room standing athwart the quarter deck, so you can salute the flag and hand him your ID on the way in. But I'd like to invite everybody who is with us live, because this is a free-for-all. We have our list of questions we want to talk about, but you might have a better idea. I invite you to go into the chat room. Roll in a question there. We'll be monitoring it during the course of the show. And if you're feeling a little more extroverted and adventurous today, you can call the switchboard. And it's right there on the webpage. But in case you're tooling around, the number is area code 347-308-8397. 347-308-8397. And I don't have no guest to introduce. So, hey, Eagle One, good afternoon.
Hey there, Sal. How are you?
I'm still looking for my Valentine's Day present, but that's okay. If I'm persistent enough, eventually one will show up.
Well, you didn't buy your own?
Well, you know, man's got to do what a man's got to do sometimes. Now, I got one of my daughter's... My daughter is home for a winter break from school for a few days, so that's my Valentine's Day present. I get one of my girls home for a little while. So we're doing all right. And she even let me come do the show today, so I guess we're in good shape.
All right. Can't beat that. Yeah, I'm really enjoying my new hiking quilt, so I'll have to tell my wife about it sometime.
Yeah, I didn't get a chance to go bird hunting as much this hunting season as I wanted to, but I was talking to an acquaintance of mine who did a lot of hunting, and he was talking about, yep, my dog right now just wants to lay on the couch and not do anything all day. I was like, I hate to tell you, because it had a big season, because my dogs are doing the same thing. With the weather, though, we're having pretty good weather down here at the tropical headquarters. But at the Midrat Southern Command, I know most of the country has had a little bit under the weather. And, you know, when we had the – and sometime later on the show, if we run out of questions, I may tap you on the shoulder because you're our disaster response guru. I might get you to pontificate about Texas. But, you know, I was thinking, getting ready for today's show, that, you know, we talked a little bit about the results of the election, and the new administration only has about a month under their belt, but I think we've seen enough to a certain extent to talk about it, because one of the things that I remember from 4 years ago, because you and I and our guests started talking about it right after the 2016 election, because at least going into the administration, navalists and those who see pretty clearly the requirements for the fleet we need, we got kind of excited because it was part of the campaign. There was a lot of talk about it. So at least we had the wind at our back. But not that it's anti-Navy or anything, but we find ourselves 4 years later with a new administration, with new priorities. And we talk about it on a regular basis here as well about, you know, who in Congress could help, if nothing else. And I had a little bit of a pity party when I saw who's being assigned to the Sea Power and Defense Committees in the Senate. They're great patriots, lovely Americans, and I'm sure they're wonderful and wise people and all. But you didn't see their some of the players you thought you were. And I asked a few people who know more about what goes on in the Beltway more than I do, and it almost became for many of them it was the booby prize. Well, you weren't able to get this or this because that person has seniority and got a more important committee. So we're going to give you this instead. And that just tells me not that it's going to be a navalist winter, but the wind's not at our back. We don't have a headwind. We're kind of in the doldrums. And if you try to be positive about it, because I am a closet optimist, maybe this is an opportunity for other people outside the executive and the legislative branch, are those who aren't at the senior levels at least, to do some additional work, to set some foundations, get some people thinking, preparing the ship and the groundwork, so to speak, for when there is a tailwind again, to be able to do more than we were able to accomplish the last 4 years. But maybe you have a more optimistic view of things, but I just do not see a wildly fruitful and productive 4 years coming up from an ableist point of view. But then again, if we thought we were going to get great things 4 years ago and we got nothing, perhaps if we think we're getting nothing now, 4 years from now, we're going to go, wow, what a great administration for the Navy side of the house. But I'm not that much of an optimist.
Yeah, I'm probably more. First thing is, I think that a lot of good foundational work has been laid by our friends Brian McGrath and Jerry Hendricks and Jim Holmes and a number of other people who've gotten. We're getting to see a lot more about how the importance of sea power to our nation's defense and sea trade and a strong merchant marine through guys like Sal Mercoliano and other people. Discussing things like and one of the guests we had who discussed the importance of the Jones Act, whether or not it's stifling or helping America's sea power. But, you know, at least the discussion is started. And it looks like the Navy League is actually doing what they used to do, which is supporting the effort to communicate about how important sea power is to what essentially is an island nation, or at least a two ocean nation. And plus we have a whole bunch of assets that are like Hawaii, which the new chairman of the Sea Power Committee from the Senate is from, and all those other islands that we own out in the Pacific. I think that's a really good sign. I'm not as concerned about decommissioning a few PCs. Those things were old, probably maintenance nightmares at this point. But I wish that we had some really strong, before we start throwing equipment that works away, I wish we had some really strong equipment already in place to take over the responsibilities those PCs have. And I don't think a ship the size of the LCS is a good substitute for a ship the size of a PC. It just doesn't work that way. And then, as you already noted, somebody's making the effort to get rid of the Mark 48s or whatever the small riverine littoral boats that some of them currently based in Guam, but are really suitable for the kind of operation you might have around, say, the islands of the Philippines and some of the other island chains out there, certainly in Micronesia and Northern Marianas Islands and a bunch of other places. I think that I don't know who's behind getting rid of those, but that seems to be really short-sighted, again, unless you have some strong replacement or if you actually foresee no mission for those. But if I go back to, I think a CNO was around when President Obama was in charge of things, he talked about payloads, not platforms. And if you stick as well as you can a number of decent missiles or on these smaller boats or ships, or you let them tow. Here we go. I'll go again with my missile barges. You let them carry out other assets that they can throw in the water and use to shoot things. You know, I think you're creating, by having to develop bigger ships, you're just costing us more, you know, more money, and you're wasting assets we currently have. I kind of like what the Russians do and have done for years, which I don't think they ever throw anything away. I know they've got some ships that they've kind of let lie fallow, but if you look at the way they run their air force and their the strongest part of their navy has always been their naval air power, but they don't, you know, they're flying things that look like B-29 still, and that's kind of amazing to me. I don't know why we insist that there's a half life on this equipment when much of it could be reused. I know the Gearing class destroyer that I was on was later sold. You know, we found it unfit for our use, but it was later sold to the Taiwan Navy, and they used it for a number of years before they finally got rid of it and made it into razor blades or whatever. So I think we're hasty sometimes, and the haste makes for waste. Speaking of which, one of the problems that I foresee coming up is that there's so much waste, fraud, and abuse in the various programs we already have, the COVID-19 programs. You know, we're talking billions of dollars and not enough to build carriers and submarines and ships. And, you know, we've got to get a grip on this, where this borrowed money we're spending like a drunken sailor. And we need to get a grip on it, or you know, we're just going to spend ourselves into the poorhouse and not have anything tangible like ships and aircraft and other good things to have to defense of the country to show for where all that money went.
Yeah, I think you hit on one thing, that it's the 800-pound gorilla in the room, that it's not a problem till it is. But and I get grumpy faces at some of my friends who tell me the budgets don't matter, don't tell me about the deficit, we have to have this type of military, and we just need to spend the money for it. It doesn't work that way. And if anybody looks at our national debt, where it is, and where the historical norms are for that, we are way off the chart here. We are putting the real hard part is we are putting the U.S. dollar status as a reserve currency and long-term threat, and all these bills are going to come due. And when they do, people are going to look around for somebody to hold accountable. And the sad thing is, there used to be a sense of stewardship and a long-term view of things that for some reason is no longer important. And most of the people who have made these decisions are no longer with us, or soon will no longer be with us. But some people are going to have to fix it. And unless you are under an existential crisis, the military is going to be the first thing to be cut, because it's the easiest thing to be cut, because it does not have a constituency like some of the other programs. And so we will see that. That's one of the things that I've kind of used as my Cassandra moment, that was first briefed to me by one of my economics professors in 97, who saw all this coming, and all based upon demographics and trends and politics. And it's COVID has just done two things, I think. It has pushed the timeline to the reckoning to the left because of how much we spent. But more dangerous is, within the last year, we've seen the conversation move from we need to give extra unemployment benefits to people who have lost their job, to we need to send money to every adult. That's huge. And, you know, modern monetary theory is kind of like amphetamines. In the short term, you can take it and you go, God, this stuff is great. I've been able to do all this stuff I've never been able to do before. I feel great. I feel healthy. All this great stuff is going on. These amphetamines are awesome. That's true. That works in the short term. But in the long term, it destroys you. And that's what the spending has done to us. And that's one of the things and one of the reasons why I have hoped that we'd be able to get to an argument about priorities. Because if we maintain our present spending priorities where for political reasons, mostly involving around not wanting to have the Air Force and the Army and the Navy say bad things about each other. Also, our consolidated defense industry doesn't like commotion. If we keep dividing the pie the same way we have, when the bar bill comes due and it needs to be paid, if that overall size of the pie shrinks and we're not able intellectually or by habit to be able to reallocate that pie in a better way to attenuate serious risks, then everybody's going to get smaller. And that can't happen. If the budget has to drop by 20%, then we as a nation need to decide where we need to really invest our money so that not everything drops by 20%. Maybe some drop by 5%, some drop by 40%. That is not a conversation, unfortunately, enough of the people want to have. I don't know when that bill is going to take place, but I would encourage everybody to look at just, they don't have time to look at the whole thing, but hold of some charts that involve debt service. Then get hold of a chart that look at interest rates, and then expand your horizontal axis by 75 years. And if you don't know enough math, know what happens to debt service when you go from paying, I'll just use round numbers, 3% interest on your debt to 6% interest on your debt, learn, because we're going to learn the hard way here. Later more than sooner. But, if you're talking about long-term trends in the military, yeah, that's the big one right there is we're just not going to be able to afford a lot of the things that people want to do. And I think if the bill starts to come due over the course of the next 4 years, I don't see anybody advocating for holding the line. I think the first thing they can do to dump weight, if you want to use an aviator point of view, or the easiest thing they can start cutting to get money, it's going to be defense. And I can also see a very valid argument, and people can defend it, that if countries like Finland, Taiwan, and Romania and Germany only are spending 1.2% on their military budget and they don't seem worried, why can't we? Yeah, that's a good question.
Well, it reminds me of this really excellent article that Angry Staff Officer wrote. It's up on his blog. It's called "Good Intentions Do Not a Good Commander Make." I'm going to kind of read this a little bit out of order, but so much of leadership can come down to this: good intentions don't make you a good commander or a good leader. The road to hell is famously paved with good intentions, and I'd add that road to being a smug and self-satisfied commander also has similar paving options. And what he's talking about is he tried to make some minor, what he thought were minor changes to the schedule of his troops, and found that it was driving his troops crazy. And he had ignored the second and third order effects of these decisions. As he said, in my haste to fix one problem, I'd cause additional problems. It was a valuable lesson that I learned. Good intentions aside, you have to look at just how these decisions will have trickle-down effects. And that is exactly what you're just talking about. You know, if you're going to give free money to people, and you're going to save the states who've gotten themselves into financial trouble from themselves by dumping billions of dollars on them, and you're going to do a bunch of other stuff because you're going to have all this $1.9 trillion pool of money to disperse over X number of years, it's going to have trickle-down effects, and those trickle-down effects are just what you identify. Where can you cut? You know, if you can cut, we're not going to build that next submarine, We're not going to build an additional carrier. We're going to, because the media is not going to show starving kids because they don't see, you know, if you cut welfare benefits, if you reduce some of these social programs, the pictures on the news are going to be of sunken cheeked children. You know, it's like what got us into Somalia, these starving baby pictures, which, you know, should not drive political and defense decisions. But you know they're going to, because it's a lot easier to cut programs that don't make good pictures of sad-faced E7s looking unhappy. But that's not the same thing as a child with tears in its eyes and skin and bone showing, or one of those starvation bellies like on Somali babies. You know, it's hard not to be cynical about it. You know what's going to happen. You know how it's going to be manipulated by the people who will manipulate it. But those are second and third order effects. And it's one of the things about, you know, when you lose an election or when you win an election, you get to make these decisions and they have these ramifications. And it may be you have good intentions, but if your good intentions result in the country being unable or less able to defend itself, that is an effect that ought to be discussed out loud. And somebody needs to be weighing these things carefully and with great consideration, instead of just, well, that's just, you know, that's just the military guys. They always want more money. Now, that being said, we've got to be a lot smarter. We cannot keep demanding that every huge ship is the best thing in the world. That's what I was talking about. These smaller ships. We've got to be able to use the tools we have. If it's and think small. Small is cheaper in many ways. Manning levels are smaller. You can. And this is where Finland, you were talking about Finland and those countries, you know, they don't have a worldwide presence. Finland can get by with 1.9% of defense of its budget because they don't have a worldwide presence. They're not providing security for the sea lanes in the Indian Ocean and the Pacific and the Arabian Gulf. That job has fallen to us for some reason. And that's not to say we can't quit. You know, and maybe that's something that really we ought to be looking at. How, you know, I think we've spent several $1 trillion in the Middle East since 9/11, and Lord knows we spent a bunch of money before 9/11. I mean, when were we first fooling around with big ships being escorted by naval vessels, or vice versa, as the case turned out to be? You know, for all those operations we did during the tanker wars. It is a commitment that we made a long time ago under the Carter Doctrine, and maybe it's time for a Democratic president to look at a policy that was created by one of the Democratic predecessors and say, well, it's time to get out of there. Second order effects again. If you start shutting down your fracking, if you start doing some of the other things that have happened on the energy front, then you're no longer energy self-sufficient, and all that does is create a greater dependency on the Middle East. Somebody needs to be thinking how this all fits together, and I'm not sure who's doing that, if anyone.
Yeah, it's the we need, and this is always true, but sometimes it exacerbates itself. Is we need more decisions based on reason and less on emotion. Because a lot of what we talked about here, it's all based on emotion. I think well-meaning people can argue about how much humans are contributing or not contributing to climate change, which of course is always changing. But what you can't deny is the fact that a modern society has to have energy. How are you going to create that energy in an affordable manner? Affordable being your average family, where when people say, well, you know, inflation has gone down. Not if you're a family, it hasn't. Whether it's housing prices or a lot of the other prices, it costs a lot of money to raise a family. And energy has got a lot to do with that. And energy security was great for two reasons, mostly because we're not reliant on other people overseas, but also it brought the price that it takes to commute to work, to go on a vacation with your kids, to heat your house. And we've all seen these new policies where, and I don't mean to insult anybody, but there is a lot of talk about hydrocarbons that is approaching anti-hydrocarbons, whether it's anti-coal, anti-natural gas even, anti-car, that's almost become religious, where you have to make a certain declaration and believe certain things, or you are considered an apostate. But they also will reject reasonable things like nuclear power. But again, that's kind of going down a rabbit hole. But if we lose our energy independence, you're right, we will have to look again at other parts of the world. We can't get all of our fuel from the UK and Norway, where we'll be sending our petrodollars to fund countries that aren't always in alignment with what we want. Iran, Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, what other garden spot do you want to mention that is where those overseas hydrocarbons are? I would much rather see the Chinese embrace that briar patch, to mix a metaphor, because I'm not allowed to say the actual story anymore, than us. But I think in the fall, gas was under two. Now, at least in my part of the country, it's if I find a nice my favorite place in Georgia, I can pay $2.40 for it. That's going up. I can afford that. Not everybody can. But that energy independence is a huge part of our security, and also our major competitor, China. That's the source of their major insecurity, which is driving a lot of what they're doing. But also, it becomes a critical vulnerability. Our domestic ability to be energy independent is a critical asset. Their energy dependence is a critical vulnerability, just like it used to be with us. So all these efforts to decrease our ability to produce what we need here, it decreases the utility of our critical capability, critical ability, however you want to name it, and it increases our critical vulnerability, which is unfortunate, because when we got energy independence, the argument that a lot of people, and this really is nonpartisan, because you'll find people both to the left and the right who would like to do that, who are saying something similar to what you said a little while ago, is, you know, why are we stuck in the 1970s when it comes to the Middle East? Why do we feel the need to put nuclear aircraft carriers in what effectively is a very big lake known as the Persian Gulf or Arabian Gulf, depending upon who we want to piss off at the day, moment in time? A lot of that's habit. A lot of that is the warping of our COCOM structure. But I think a very good argument, if you have energy independence, can be made on both sides of the spectrum. And I think if you ask the American public, hey, are you willing to have another 5,000 young men and women killed and tens of thousands wounded for the rest of their life to go into the Middle East again to defend China and Italy's access to fuel? I don't think so. I don't think the consent of the governed is in play there if it's not our houses that need to be heated, our cars that need to be run off of it. And boy, if you could take the CENTCON commitment now and return it to what it was as a percentage of our national interest in 1972. Of course, there are other things that were concerned in 1972 we don't need to do either. But then maybe you could absorb or at least adjust better to a declining interest in spending money on the military. So it's all... There are second and third order effects to these big ticket items that I don't think are being looked at in what I think you're asking for in a holistic way. You can do it in a holistic way, but I don't know whether this is soundbite or whatever, but everybody wants to look at it, talk about it, and argue it in little tiny bites. And they all play in together. And unfortunately, that's not part of the conversation.
Yeah, it's. I mean, this is one of those great, interesting times that we always want to live in, where, isn't that the old Chinese, pretend, I don't know if that's a real Chinese curse or not, but it ought to be. You know, President Biden has already backed off the support for the Saudis in the Yemeni mess, the Hutus and all that. I don't know how that's going to play out, other than probably make the Saudis mad. I don't know what he's going to do about Syria. The administration he was previously part of got us into that mess, and we're still fooling around in it. You know, I think he promised at one point to end endless wars. And maybe we will get out of Afghanistan eventually, if that's a good idea. I mean, again, you know, if you, my magic eight ball is not working these days. It's hard to say which is the best pasture. You know, maintain a small group of people there. You know, should we take up the idea again of punitive expeditions, which I thought that's what we were going to do. We originally went into Afghanistan, but you know, we get. How much nation building of other nations do we need to do? You know, how much are we driven by, again, these photo ops of and God help the poor Syrian people. You know, how many things are driven by the fact that the Bashar Assad is such a jerk, you know, and he has no hesitation to maintain power by killing his own people. It's just, you know, those questions are way beyond me. But I do know that, and you know, I understand the green people. I understand people saying, "Look, it's environmentally important that we have these large windmill. What do they call those things? I call them windmills that can generate electricity, and they do provide when the weather conditions are right. They do provide a nice amount of electricity, and they, except for the fact they kill a lot of birds, they're probably environmentally better than some other things. But you know, you have to have a you asked about Texas. I'll talk a little bit about the Texas situation. If you're going to plan for a condition that exists, you know, hadn't existed in 100 years since the last time I think Texas had a really serious cold freeze. I was there for a few of them.
Over 100
not
years.
Not,
I saw 1898.
Yeah. If you're going to try and plan for those 100-year events or more than 100-year events, how much are you willing to spend? How much are you willing to charge the ratepayers for the energy that's going to be used to develop a structure that in the worst possible heat wave and in the worst possible cold wave that you can imagine will meet all the needs? I mean, I don't know what that would cost, but I think that would cost a lot. And so, you know, you're just like in your own house, you know, do people, I don't know about everybody else, but you know, do you plan for the worst possible catastrophe that could happen to your home? Have you got a hurricane shelter built into your house that you and your family can rush into? Or are you assuming that, you know, on a normal event, yeah, you get hit by a hurricane, but you know, that's just how much of the risk to your particular house? I don't know how risk adverse are you, and how much are you willing to pay to prevent that from causing a major disruption in your life? And not that living in a shelter where your house is being destroyed around you would not be a major disruption in your life. But, you know, all of us make these calculated gambles on what we actually can do to protect ourselves from kind of what may be the worst case situation. So, you know, those of us who live in hurricane areas tend to keep, you know, a little extra water around the house. Because of my hiking stuff, I keep, you know, these freeze-dried foods that last forever. I've got hiking stoves. I mean, you know, things that I can use that I multi-purpose with. And I would think that, you know, most people, if they can afford that, have some kind of system of, you know, if this happens, I've got this. If this happens, I've got that. Now, and a lot of people, I guess, assume that the Red Cross and the federal government's going to, or the state government is going to bail them out if they get in these ugly situations. But, You know, it, again, Texas got hit with a storm that like they hadn't seen since 1898 or 1899. How often is that going to happen, and how much are you willing to spend to prevent the effects from being as bad as they were? And I have the feeling it's a lot less when you take a look at what it would actually cost the ratepayers. They'd be willing to spend a lot less to do that than maybe they would be if you asked them today, as they're just coming back, their water is just coming back online.
Yeah, that's the key, is, you know, the reasonable consideration. For instance, the house I live in right now was built immediately after Hurricane Andrew, and they had new building construction requirements here. And talking to the contractor, had been doing it for a few months, and was showing me what was all done here and there. Basically what it was is, I forget the exact amount, but whereas before your houses were ready for sustained winds of 110, this gave a sustained winds of 125. But occasionally you get those once-in-a-century storms that'll hit a very narrow area at 150. So, you know, it cost more to build our house that year than it would have been if we built it 3 years earlier. But if the requirement had been not 130 or 120, whatever it was, but 150, we probably wouldn't have been able to afford the house. So, yeah, it's unfortunately, you know, I thought we were through with the election season, but I guess election season never ends. So much of the conversation coming out of Texas has been about dirtying people up for the 2022 or 2024 election. It's so stupid. It's kind of like COVID here where I live in Florida. Half the crap you have to filter out because they're trying to dirty up the governor who's going to run for governor in 22, and you know, he's in the 24. But I think what's really going to be interesting, and I listened to a podcast when running some errands across state lines, all legal, by the way, this weekend, that part of the problem in Texas is you know, the anti-wind turbine people said a half-truth, but the whole truth was, yeah, you know, wind turbines are less than 10% of the power generation, but I'm using round figures here, but 80% of them didn't work, and they were the highest percentage of the other of power generation that didn't work, which is why they got so much attention. But natural gas froze up. The nuclear power plant pumps had problems as well, because it just isn't supposed to get that cold, and it wasn't engineered to be that cold. A lot of the transfer stations, even though they were weatherized, because in Texas it does get cold, especially in the panhandle, but you don't get Siberian weather there. And it just, it's kind of like, you know, an airplane where, you know, why did the wing fall off the airplane? Well, the wing was designed to take a load of no more than 7 G's. They pulled 8.5 G's and the wing popped off. Well, they should have designed it for 10 G's. Well, a human being won't survive 10 G's. You know, that is the same thing. You know, what are your design limitations? And sometimes you have these events that take place that knock you out, which, you know, going back to your hurricane example, because I grew up with hurricanes, they don't bother me. I'm not going to get flooded out because of where I live. So I don't leave in hurricanes. I can live for a few weeks without power and without water if I need to. And a lot of my neighbors do as well, because I'm prepared for them. And I think that's maybe one of the commentators said, you know, nobody can make fun of Mormons this week, because Mormons, because of their heritage and their history, they keep supplies. I forget how it's a couple of three, four months of supplies they keep on hand.
I think it's 6 months.
Okay, it's 6 months. Well, you know, maybe people need to do that. There are some parts of the country that are more vulnerable to that than others, but there's other things that can happen that Mother Nature's got nothing to do with that might force you to go back to the early 20th century for a couple of weeks till everybody gets in line. I think as things thaw out, we're probably going to see some pretty uncomfortable things that nobody could have done anything about, mostly about cattle. There was a lot of talk about a rush of illegal immigrants coming across the Mexican border, going through the desert. There's always lots of drug running through the deserts. I don't know how much those people watch the Weather Channel, but there's a non-zero number of people, I think, that after the fall just couldn't make it through the weather, and that'll be a tragedy.
Yeah, Paul corrects us. He says it's a one-year supply of food for the Mormons, and Sal Mergliano, no. The Mormons do not include beer in their one-year shelf storage, since the body is a temple. And
not that I've looked closely at this as part of my my hurricane supply. However, I would not recommend beer for long-term storage. However, liquor is great long-term storage because, unlike wine and beer, it doesn't spoil, and you can drink it warm. Speaking from experience. Because when you have a limited amount of refrigerant and you ask your beloved if you could take something out so you could chill the bourbon, she goes, no. But you got to drink it when it's warm. So, yeah, Mormons don't have a one-year supply of scotch and vodka and stuff. But, yeah, if you got to store that for medicinal purposes, then you do need to stick with the hard liquor there, Sal.
Or brandy.
Or brandy. Hey, you know, you brought up something earlier that I saw some really good people talking about frustrated. And I didn't talk about it as much as I wanted to or write about it as much as I wanted to. You know, the as we continue to divest ourselves of the small ships, I looked again at I'm getting the acronym right, but the Swedish, is it NC-90? Anyway, they're a nice little gunboat that they have. And the people who are saying, well, you know, this doesn't help us in a great power competition. I'm sorry. When have we really been good at predicting the next war? We got to have some flex. We got to have some flexibility. You know, are we gonna send an Arleigh Burke cruiser up the Congo River, or the Amazon, or look around the
world. I had a dream about taking a destroyer up a river. It was very exciting. So it turns out it's a SWO, common SWO dream.
Sandbars.
It was carrying it over. It was portaging over the rocks that was difficult.
What, that sonar dome that always gets in the way. But I just I thought that was unfortunate. Hey, we actually have a caller from area code 904. So hey, we're gonna take a stab in the dark. I wonder if it's Lee or maybe Byron out there. But hey, area code 904. This is Sal. You're on Midrats Live, so don't screw it up.
No. I'm just listening in.
Wait, is this Lee?
I can't get the damn speakers on my PC to do it, so I'm just listening on the phone.
Okay. Well, Lee.
You got me on. All right. Okay. Let's talk boats for a second. The N95 is completely reshuffling the deck when it comes from vessels all the way from harbor protection all the way up to patrol ship. N95 writes the requirements for those, and they are completely redoing it. And what really scares me is the guy who's deciding on which boats we should and which patrol ships we shouldn't have is a Marine. Pardon me if there's any Marines out there, but they don't know boats. I'll put that out and let somebody speak up.
Yeah, well, thanks, Lee. You know, you brought up a good, you know, people are policy. And You know, I don't like it. I like people getting diversity, the experience and stuff like that, but that's not the background that we need of somebody to decide whether they're small. And if you want to be conspiratorial, maybe that was one of the reasons that they're making the move, because they look at who they have in there right now. And the present commandant of the Marine Corps, he has a rather interesting view of everything. And for those that know Marines, when the commandant says, put on a tutu, the rest of the Marines say, sir, do you want pink or blue? They're very good at following the lead. So, yeah, I just think back to 03, 04, where we had to defend the Haditha Dam. We had Army guys who were finding, quote unquote, people's fishing boats and putting crew-served weapons on the bow to try to secure the bridge. And all up and down the Tigris and Euphrates, those that were killing and maiming Americans and our allies during the invasion, 03 and 04, they had relatively unfettered access for transport and supply on the rivers, because there was nobody there to patrol it. All those forces that we had from Vietnam and that we even had into the Naval Reserve up until the late 1990s when they got rid of it, were thrown away. And unfortunately, we didn't convince the Colombians to come join us in the invasion, because it would sure have been nice to have had a couple of those Colombian riverine squadrons in there. And people saying we're not going to need that in the next war, we've needed them in every war that we have been in. Besides Korea, maybe we had some in Korea that I don't know about, but it's sad. People will go, why don't we have this capability again? And we'll be able to look back at this time when we got rid of it. And next time that we have a watchkeeper on a bridge who does something stupid and at sea and hits a rock, or God forbid, hits another ship, and they review and they realize how little time he, his XO and his CO have of actual bridge time. And we'll go, why don't we have more experienced people at sea? Why don't we have people with great command experience? Because we got rid of all those opportunities. I've been kind of grumpy about watching us just decouple and move away from small ships, when in the large scheme of things, the capabilities are just tremendous. And for those that follow me on Twitter, if you go back about 30 minutes ago, I retweeted something that Byron sent me a few days ago. I want to say it was PC 14 or 17, back a few years ago when they came in to do service on it. And it's, you know, the PCs are old, but we should have already commissioned their replacements years ago. But they're old ships, kind of like the Spruances, driven hard, perhaps not given the amount of depot level support that they needed over the course of time. But they're going to decommission themselves eventually. They're so worn out. But it's kind of like our command ships and kind of like our icebreakers. They're not sexy. People don't like talking about it. I thought that we had senior people who are adults and didn't need to sound sexy and hip, but I guess they do. So nobody has found the money to replace them. So we just have really worn out, really old ships that eventually just disappear with no replacements. And it's sad. I don't know. We'll see who our next civilian leadership of the Navy is saying, and how much they decide to stir the pot in the finest traditions of the naval service, or how much they're going to go along to get along. I think the smart money is on the latter, not the former.
Well, it's not like the Navy leadership itself has not been exposed to the concept of the need for the. I mean, if any of these guys have read Wayne Hughes and his books, he keeps arguing for smaller ships and missile capable small ships. He talks about where we fight war at sea. We don't fight. The great blue water engagements have been rare. We fight in the choke points. We fight in the littorals. We fight in the off islands. It's not like we go out in the middle of the Atlantic and except for a convoy escort and what the submarine force does when they're interdicting when they're doing trying to stop the flow of goods. Even then, the coastal routes in Indochina during World War II, U.S. submarine force played a huge role in shutting down the Japanese economy and stopping the materials they needed to fight the war from getting to them. But otherwise, we fight wars in close-in waters. We do not need these behemoths that we have. They're great for anti-ballistic missiles and for taking care of the fleet anti-aircraft picture and all that, but they are really not meant to engage other ships at sea. We don't want the other ships to get close enough to our capital ships for them to engage other than by missiles. So if you're in a fight with missiles with your big blue water ships, what you need are smaller, faster, really heavily armed ships for the close-in area. And Wayne Hughes has discussed this in his books and in other sources, and a lot of other people have agreed with him, and yet it doesn't ever seem to catch on at the headquarters level, and it just baffles me. Claude Barraby and I several years ago wrote a piece for National Interest on Trump's gunboats, and I saw Claude revive that the other day, when they started cutting these small ships and boats again. I just don't understand what big Navy is thinking. And other than, as you say, it's more prestigious, I guess, to be CEO of a cruiser or a DDG than it is to be the skipper as a lieutenant of a small boy.
You want to watch a group of people get deflated real fast. You get the I wish I was a TEDx speaker crowd together, and they start prattling on about distributed lethality. I like to say, let's talk about distributed risk, because all these large ships, and this is a lot about what Wayne Hughes goes to. I just have my own flavor to it. It's because I'm in the same people that I don't think really appreciate how big a Virginia class submarine is, or how big our SSGNs, and if we do an SSGN version of the Columbia class ballistic missile submarine, how huge those are. And especially when you go west of Wake on the other side of the Pacific, there's not very many bodies of water you can move those around in. I know we're not allowed to tell people that there's topography underneath the surface of the water, but there is, and it matters. But I am firmly in the long war school. Long war being that these people who say that we need to build a force so that everybody knows that we're going to defeat them in 72 hours, I think is a historical foolishness. I think anybody who has an eighth grade understanding of history knows that most of our major wars were supposed to be short wars. Short wars are very rare. That's not what you need to plan for. And in a long war, if we're talking about our, great power competition, everybody is scared, rightfully so, about the Chinese communist dominance in short range and immediate range conventionally armed ballistic missiles. All your land air bases belong to us, as the cool kids would say. But that's a short war weapon. Those weapons are going to be either expended or eliminated in 2 weeks. And if your war is not over in that 2 weeks, what are you going to fight with? How are you going to get in their business? How are you going to project power? Because you're no longer going to have waves of dozens of these ballistic missiles trying to hit your air bases and your ships at sea. You're going to have onesies and twosies because we're going to be playing whack-a-mole. And if we get into a big war out there, hopefully somebody thinking like I am, and we tell the Chinese, you can either stop or we're blowing the Yangtze dam. We do that, it's the equivalent of flooding the entire Midwest. There's a big butcher bill to that, but you know, welcome to great power competition. We need to have ships, like you said, that are numerous. I know that the Street Fighter School and other people have gotten in trouble for saying this. They're not expendable. I thought that was the wrong terminology, but what you need to do, and we've discussed this critique here before, is when your group of ships comes over the horizon, you can't look at it and go, if we lose one of these, we have to go home. No. You need to know, okay, how many of these ships can we lose and still be able to accomplish the mission? If I say 20% and you say, hey, then I can't do my mission, then you don't have the right size fleet because you're going to take losses. You're going to take big losses, especially the way we build ships nowadays. Damage control is great. It might not sink, but it's not going to be able to create effects ashore. And by having your risk distributed, as opposed to your lethality distributed, which actually they go hand in hand, you have the ability to do that. But if we need to accomplish small things off some island near the Philippines, and we don't have a small ship to do it, and instead we send an Aegis ship to do it, then we got nobody to blame but ourselves when that ship hits a contact mine that was designed in 1949, built in 1968, and was taken out of storage 2 months earlier. Then that's our fault.
Yeah, well, you'd think we'd learn the lesson, but we don't. And, I mean, I argued this, God, I don't know, when I first started doing things on piracy. Why in the world we have Aegis cruisers out there trying to fight pirates? You know, I even back in those days, I argued we should have taken up ships or the offshore oil boats and turned them into anti-piracy ships and have those things out running around with lieutenants in charge, Lieutenant JG's in charge. You know, give them the experience of being in command, low risk to them, low risk to the pirates, really. And, you know, all you're doing with the Aegis-class cruiser is just wasting a blue water ship on a mission that could have been done by basically a Coast Guard 42-footer. And should have probably been done by the Coast Guard, the kind of ships the Coast Guard uses, some of their patrol boats and stuff, because that's what it called for. And instead, we always, because, you know, when you only have a hammer, everything looks like a nail, I guess. So, yeah, let's send Aegis-class cruisers. Let's send these huge amphibs. Let's, that'll help us find these small fiberglass boats with a couple of pirates with an RPG and a few AK-47s. Made no sense then. Makes no sense now. Hello? Uh-oh. We lose Sal?
No, Sal forgot his mute button. I was making wonderful things, saying wonderful things about our Coast Guard. I love to tease the Coast Guard more than anybody, maybe, but they're building some nice ships. And the Australians have a really nice ship, which I guess is the equivalent of a fast response cutter, is what we would call it. I can't remember the name of the ship off the top of the head, but off the top of my head. But you know, these things could be upgunned pretty quickly. But everybody keeps talking about, you know, the West Pacific, the South China Sea and stuff like that. How many of them have actually looked at draw a line from the top of the Philippines due west down to Singapore. That's a dangerous bit of water that, however, has a lot of places that you can do a lot of things with more reasonably sized ships along those lines. Yeah, they don't have the range to maybe do a transpac by themselves, but that's okay. They don't need to. It's the Coast Guard has put together some good ships, I think. And talking to Coast Guard guys, they're like, you know, shut up. We don't want you to take them. We're happy with them. So I don't know what you heard from the Coast Guard guys, but maybe we could look at some of their, not the ships themselves, but what I find interesting is the mindset of the program office that comes up with them.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and I would think this is just me guessing, but I would think that the program office, PEO, for the small boat groups, a small ship group, you know, the something less than size than, oh God, anything's almost less than size than an LCS, but you know, that group, the PCs, the mine runs, you know, that group has got to be, that guy's probably down there just frustrated as all get out because he knows there are assets out there. If you look at what the Singapore Navy's doing, they've got these terrific new hulls coming in the water that are going to do all the things that our LCS was supposed to do, except I think they're going to make it work. I mean, they've already got, I put a thing up on my blog the other day about how they had used basically a drone and another drone to blow up an explosive hazard in the water, you know, so they can send out a remote control boat, they can launch a remote control device, and that device will, if you're talking about that 1940 mine, that device will hit that mine and blow it up, and there's no danger to anybody, any human being, and it's all done remotely. Now, why on earth are we not in this business? I know that we've got we're making the effort, but somebody needs to go look at what the Singapore folks are doing and say, hey, you know, and I know that I think they own Halt Marine now. I mean, why are we not developing this stuff, building this stuff on our own shores and getting it out where we need it? And you're right, the South China Sea is a place where these smaller units could operate with great effectiveness and should be out there and bring back tenders. Lord Almighty, you know, if we're worried about their maintenance and stuff, well, park a tender somewhere and let them pull up alongside and get treated the way we used to get treated by tenders in the Navy, which was always very, very nice. So soapbox du jour.
Well, as usual, once we get talking, we use up an hour pretty fast. I still have only three of my 10 questions that we address. Well, that's good because if we have challenging guests, we can always do a free-for-all. Sal and Lee, Paul, really appreciate y'all coming in on the chat room. And Lee, you can call in anytime to listen, or you can go get a new computer or one of the two, because you always seem to have sound troubles. But I do appreciate everybody joining us live. We do have some guests lined up. We just had some scheduling challenges. We may have some pre-records because we're trying to get a time. Jeremy Strohs, who we've had before over in Europe, that time match is a challenge. So for the listeners, we're looking at revisit that and a few other items coming up. But besides that, I don't know about everybody else, but at least where I am, the maple trees are pushing out red. The redbud trees are pushing out purple. And today I had, in addition to two of my peach varieties, I've also got some other fruit that are pushing out here. So spring's on the way, everybody. And we'll catch you soon.
Yeah, I think we're seeing some crocuses up here. So you're right. Spring is on the way. And so, oddly enough, it's hiking season. So, who knows where I'll be?
Time to get off the couch.
It is time to get off the couch.
And
anyway, I second what you say about the guys in the chat room. They're a lot of fun and always educational. And so I've copied it all now. I have to go look a lot of stuff up. So thank you. Thank you, guys. Chat room people. And like Sal, you all have a great great week. Sal said, have a great week.
Have a great Navy day and tap your hat to the Coast Guard program office. Cheers, everybody.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. Tipperary, but my heart's right there.